Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for the second week of December. I am political reporter Elise Hugh, joined by CEO and editor-in-chief Evan Smith.
Hi, Elise.
Managing editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
And Ben Philpott, who is covering the governor's race for KUT News and the Texas Tribune.
Hello.
Roll Tide, Ben.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Hook 'em horns, Ross. Evan.
I'm just hoping that Ben's sweet home Alabama cell phone ring ends at some point.
As soon as they win the national
title. On January 7th, Elise.
Today four more podcasts.
Great.
Until the game, right.
Well, today we're talking the state of the GOP race, the UI tax, and Farouk Shami's campaign shakeup. We'll start with Ross and Evan, because you guys are kind of tag-teaming this topic on the Republican race.
Well, this is interesting. I mean, we have two prominent candidates, one of which hasn't really started her campaign in a way we can detail in bloody detail here. But and then we've got the spoiler. You know, there were four or five House races in the last elections that were determined by Libertarian candidates. In other words, the person who won the race won with less than 50% of the vote because there was a third-party candidate on the ballot. And we have this governor's race that we're going into where Deborah Medina, who's kind of a – she's a Republican. She's a Wharton County chair. She's kind of a teabag candidate. She sort of proudly holds the label.
She says she proudly takes that, yes.
Yeah, and she's, you know, she's – in most of the polls, she's showing up in the 5 to 10% range. That's perfect spoiler range. She could throw this into a runoff, and you know, judging from what we're seeing right now, she would take votes away, I think, from Rick Perry.
But to your point, Ross, about how one of the two candidates hasn't really started her campaign, it's December. It's approaching the middle of December.
Well, and her campaign would jump up and down and probably will when they hear this. Then I say they haven't started. But, you know, you can't find anyone who's sort of is defending outside of the campaign itself, is sort of defending the energy of this campaign, defending the message of this. We're talking about Kay Hutchison, and we should say. And,
we should say. She who shall be named.
She who shall be named. It's the sort of, if you go to a voter and you say, if you vote for this candidate, what will happen? Or what do you expect to happen? Or what do you expect to get? And there's not really an answer to that question.
I want to note on the Medina thing that our poll, at least, the Texas Tribune UT poll, found that Medina was at 7%. And still found that Perry was ahead by 12%. I mean, the interesting thing is it wasn't Medina took 7% away and therefore it was a close race. It was but for Medina, the margin might have been larger.
Right.
I want to be very careful. I know you're not saying this, and I certainly don't want to say it, not to write Senator Hutchison off in this race. This race is by no means over. But I think it is crazy for anybody in the press to pretend that it is the competitive race today that the Hutchison campaign would like us to believe. She is behind. She is behind in every measure. And if there is a poll that the Hutchison campaign has that they're sitting on that shows her competitive, please produce it immediately. Because the narrative of this race, which of course doesn't determine the outcome, all it determines is what people talk about between now and the outcome. The narrative of this race is rapidly becoming that he's way ahead and that her campaign's in trouble. And what can she possibly do at this point to fix it? It's unfair to her, but that's become the narrative. And I'm not sure that either she or her campaign is necessarily helping change that narrative.
Could it possibly be, this is kind of a conspiracy theory, but could it possibly be a strategic move? I mean, we know, and it's been published, that Kay Bailey Hutchison originally wanted a short campaign, something that ran from January to March, really, and largely on the airwaves. Could they essentially be kind of dark right now and getting ready for some sort of massive push close to the end?
You can make that argument. We've talked before about two primaries here. One of them is a financial primary where you're basically trying to impress the finance people around the state so that they will give you the money so that when you get to the real primary, you have the $1.5 million to $1.8 million a week it takes to advertise to the whole state of Texas. So, you know, Kay Hutchison is competitive in the sense that she's got a pile of money. We'll see the reports in mid-January on how much she and Perry have raised in the last 6 months. But, you know, I expect it to be a $30 to $40 million two-month primary. That's a lot of TV stuff. You know, I wish I owned a television station. But I think she'll be competitive in that way. But what's going on now is if people are perceiving, you know, sort of the insiders are perceiving that this isn't, she's not really putting up a fight yet, that's the finance primary. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see in January that Perry has had a more successful second half of 2009 financially than Hutchison has.
Well, and ask yourself, Ben, if there are major donors who are sitting here going, I'm going to write a check to her, is there a motivation for them to do that?
There isn't. And I think the idea of public perception of what her campaign is doing right now, you know, I've got a I've got a friend, longtime Republican, who talked to me this week and was always a Kay Bailey Hutchison supporter, talked to me this week and said, you know, I really like Bill White. Now, that's just one person. That's just one moderate Republican friend of mine. But but that's, you know, we talked on and on about the idea that a massive or a bloody, rather, Republican primary could have Kay Bailey Hutchison supporters, if she indeed loses, looking for to either stay out of the race or possibly looking at a moderate Democrat. Well, I have now one friend who has. Now, he didn't say he was going to vote for White, but he said, boy, you know, I sure do like White.
I'm doubtful that the KP, if Kay were to lose, and again, let's be very clear, we're not suggesting she is going to lose. We're not predicting she's going to lose. But if Kay were to lose, I would be very reluctant to say here today that I think a lot of her people are going to gravitate to Mayor White. On the other hand, I think that as she did in her announcement on Monday, she does have a case to make for electability. And, you know, our poll showed that she was a much more electable Republican in the fall against a generic Democrat than the governor was. And the reality is it is widely held, just as it's widely held from a narrative standpoint, Ben, from a perception standpoint, that she's behind now. It is also widely held that if you get past the primary and were she to emerge victorious as opposed to the governor, she would be a stronger candidate in the fall against Mayor White than he would. That seems not to be in dispute in most quarters. At all.
In all of our polling, she ran ahead of the Democrats by a greater margin
than the governor. Right? I want to come back, Elise, to this idea that you just put out, though, that somehow maybe the Hutchison campaign is waiting until January to March, and this was their plan all along. I'm hearing John McCain's voice in my head following Labor Day in 08 saying, not entirely without irony, of the Obama campaign, now we have them right where we want them. I mean, the idea that somehow the master plan was to be 12 points behind going into the first of the year and then suddenly to overwhelm the governor with an ad campaign that was somehow going to sway voters, to me, is just crazy.
Maxwell Smart.
Well, I just feel
Rudy
like
Giuliani did that when he focused on Florida, right?
Right.
Oh, by the time we get to Florida, I'll be ready.
And the only person that Giuliani ended up beating was John Connolly for the record of spending the most to get the least in the history of presidential campaigns. I mean, the fact is you do not wait until January to launch a campaign in a state this large where the amount of money spent is going to be this much and hope to overtake somebody who, whatever you think of him as governor, is a hell of a campaigner.
So let me play contrarian here, just sort of argue against what we've been saying. I mean, you know, the argument for Hutchison here is that she remains a very popular, very well-liked politician. It remains a red state. And if she can get past Rick Perry because voters think that they prefer her politics or because they're tired of Perry. He's been in office 10 years. That may or may not turn out to be an effective argument. She has enough money to make her argument in a broad way. I mean, she'll walk in with $12 million, and that's not nothing. And when she throws this up, it may change the race immediately. I guess the surprise here is that a year ago, the conventional wisdom was, you know, in all the chattering classes and among all the politicians I talked to, was that Hutchison's a really stout competitor to Perry. This is going to be a real press, and it'll probably keep the Democrats out of the race because they're going to assume that Hutchison's going to beat Perry, and they're going to assume that Hutchison's unassailable. And that the conventional wisdom has changed as much as it has is kind of the surprise here.
That's fascinating, and I only brought up what I brought up because as a political observer, I love politics the same way I love sports, because I love the narrative and the fact that, you know, the Cowboys can be up against the Giants in the first half but then get clobbered at the end by two touchdowns. So you don't really know until you know. You know, we really won't know until Election Day, and I want to kind of sit back and watch that.
No, I agree, and I think that to Ross's point, there's no question that a year ago the perception of this race was very different than it is today. The assumption was that if she only got in the race, remember twice before she had flirted with challenging him, and it was said by some in the press corps that in 02 and 06 the governor had a pair and she had a full house, and he bluffed her out of the hand. This time, you know, she was not going to be, to switch metaphors, the Kay who cried wolf, threatening to run and then not at the last minute. She was going to do it. And when people got around to the idea that she was actually going to do it, the perception in Austin at least was she can beat him.
Right.
But, it's very difficult to run a race against somebody as fierce as the governor, as well-funded as the governor, when your last serious opponent was Steve Bartlett back in the 80s. You know, Kay really hasn't had much of a race for a very long time.
Right.
And I think part of what's going on here is that her campaign hasn't been very good. Part of what's going on here is that the governor has really taken all of his various weapons and tools and thrown them at her. And if you haven't run against somebody since Steve Bartlett, who is tough as an opponent, you know, you may not have the same level of practice.
Well, Perry's battle-hardened. He's had a bunch of really, really tough races against really well-financed opponents. And, you know, he's a fighter. He's just been in all these fights. He's, you know, bring it. You know, that's kind of their position. I mean, when you talk to the people in his campaign, you talk to supporters, that sort of attitude pervades that organization. It's really interesting.
Well, we're on the subject of Perry. Let's stay on this topic. And Ben, this week, some news regarding the unemployment insurance tax for businesses in Texas. Bring us up to speed.
Well, the unemployment insurance has been a big issue ever since legislative session and the federal bailout money. The state of Texas was in line to get over $500,000.
Half a billion dollars
in money that would be paid out into the federal, into the state unemployment insurance plan, turned down by Governor Perry because of strings attached. It would have allowed different people that were not eligible for unemployment tax, unemployment insurance rather, to get it, part-time workers, some other groups. Said too many strings, we're not going to do it. Businesses know that the tax fluctuates, and that's just the way it is. Well, the tax has now fluctuated. It's tripled in what they're going to have to pay per year, per employee. People are now saying, oh, look, if you'd just taken the money. So if you'd just taken the money, it wouldn't have been tripled. You know, we're in a recession, and now they're having to pay three times the amount. Perry's office would obviously say, well, you know, look, they know this. They know that this is the way it works. They know it fluctuates. 2 years ago, the governor was giving money back to businesses from this same fund because business was so good and because there were so few people who were being unemployed that were eligible for this for these benefits. I think that there might be some kind of a unspoken rule or unspoken agreement between businesses and the governor that businesses know the governor is going to make sure that there is not an expansion of who is eligible. And that's that. No expansion. So when the rates do fluctuate, the businesses just sit on their hands. They pay the increased rate. And, you know, a couple years from now, 4 years from now, they may get some money back.
Yeah, it's curious. They haven't made a whole lot of noise about this.
There's a complex formula under this. You know, when we say that the rate's tripling for about two-thirds of the businesses that pay this tax. But if you're a business that has a lot of injured workers or has a lot of regular unemployment flow, your rates go up. And so I guess what happens here is this is a different case for every employer. And the employers that are high risk and high cost on this thing tend to have this written into their books. And I think you're right. I think there's an implicit agreement. You could see it when the business groups were lobbying this during the legislature. I don't know if it's as stark as this, but there is an implicit agreement is if you keep the rules the same as they are, we at least have predictability. Right. We know the rates are going to change based on the economy. They're going to go up sometimes. Sometimes you're going to send us a check. But all of that said, the question with the stimulus money was we were going to have an increase of some kind, and it would have been lowered by $555 million or something if they had taken that money. And the question was whether the federal requirements on who you would allow into the program were permanent or not.
Could sunset them in a few years.
That argument's behind us unless it comes up in the governor's race. But basically we have this, you know, the state didn't take this money and so we've got this big tax increase.
And the way that it would come up in the governor's race, I assume, much like the Willingham case, is in the general as opposed to the primary. It'd be very dangerous for Senator Hutchison to sort of I'm outraged that the governor didn't take federal stimulus money.
With strings attached.
Whereas I think that the Democrat in the fall is in a better position to try to beat the governor over the head with this.
That's Perry's frame. Actually, Hutchison could come in and say, you know, your business taxes wouldn't have gone up as much if he had just taken this money.
Right, but then he'll come back and say
and footnotes and
K bailout, peace out. Will be his whole thing. I mean, the reality is, I think that the Washington thing has been way overplayed.
Mm-hmm. It's still working,
but
it's working, and I'm not sure that voters are as dumb as all that. That they're not willing to make a distinction between the bad Washington and the good Washington. So all Washington is bad, really. So all seniors who vote in the Republican primary ought to refuse their Medicaid checks. I mean, the fact is, I think voters are smarter than that. But again, this gets back to the Hutchison campaign's seeming inability to deflect any attacks by the Perry campaign, because they've not managed to turn that Washington thing around in any meaningful way.
maybe somewhere in the, you know, as we watch these 12 days of Christmas videos that Elise caught the other day, we, you know, maybe day six we'll find the argument here.
Six bureaucrats of bopping? Is that what it's going to end up being? Or
tell us what this is.
Well, basically what's happening is both sides in this campaign or in the Republican race are essentially trying to drive up the negatives of the other side. And in the spirit of the holidays, we get the 12 days of Perry cronyism and the 12 days of flip-flops. One courtesy of the Perry campaign, one courtesy of the Kay Bailey campaign, you know.
Showing now on YouTube. Right?
That's right. Showing now on YouTube. I think we're on the 10th day now. We're counting down. Started with the HPV vaccine, the knock on Perry there, and started with Kay Bailey's flip-flop on, what, mudslinging or some dirty campaigning. So this is what we get. For our holiday
intellectual fair,
and this is, and honestly, this is the best the state can do. I'm always moved to ask that question. It's just really, it's depressing.
It's not the kind of argument you get in civics class. It's the kind of argument you get that moves votes. They're trying to move votes, and those are the arguments that move votes.
Question is whether the YouTube videos that they put out are going to move a single vote, or they're simply going to reaffirm the existing narrative, which I guess probably has some value to it.
Right, and this kind of goes back to the main topic here, which is that. It's tough for Kay Bailey to fight, you know, to run both as a general election candidate and as a primary candidate, because she has to get past the primary in order to get to the general. And even though she looks really great in our poll and others against a Democrat, she has to get through Perry first. And I'm not sure she's doing.
The bet that Republicans make is that if you win the Republican primary, you win the state. That this remains a red state, and you do what you can do to get out of March. And if you get out of March, all you have to do is not make any mistakes.
Ben, my question to you on your unemployment insurance thing is there a single business owner in Texas who's going to discover that his taxes or her taxes have gone up by that much and think, well, that's it, I'm not voting for the governor?
No. I think there will be some that will say, gee, this was, you know, I thought maybe double, but gosh, triple. But, you know, at the same time, it's a predictability with they know that it's going to fluctuate. They also know that next year they're not going to have to include all their part-time workers in this calculation, and so they go along and they enjoy the way it is.
If a large business says we're not hiring because our taxes went up, then you start to have a political issue. If some large companies start to do that, then you start to have then you start to get a political wave. I mean, it just kind of depends on how the economy goes.
And I just don't think there are enough businesses that have to fall under this. I mean, because we have a pretty restrictive, threshold to be able to get unemployment insurance in the first place. You know, if 100% of the workers in the state were covered by this, then that would mean 100% of the businesses were having this tripling, and then you would have an issue. But that's not the way.
Not the case. Yep.
For our kicker topic, just want to touch on Farouk Shami's campaign shakeup. We learned this week that the campaign manager, Joel Kunz, and communications director, Jason Stanford, as well as two other top-level staffers, have been removed by the candidate. It's not clear why they were fired, but they're gone now. And we know they were fired.
It wasn't a question of leaving.
It almost doesn't matter. I mean, they were in there for 15 minutes. They were, this campaign started, and almost the first news to come out of it was, well, the first news was it started. The second news was, here's their commercial. The third news was, we're replacing our staff. It's like, okay, well, that's first shakeup.
He's still running for governor as a Democrat.
Right. It had to be a little bit less attractive to professionals like Kuhn and Stanford when they signed on to the Shami campaign to discover that they would be, in their cigarette boat competing in the primary against the SS Bill White. It couldn't have been terribly attractive to them. You know, the attractive aspect of working for the Shami campaign, was, let's be honest, that the gravy train had pulled into the station. I'm not really sure that there was much to work for the Shami campaign, except that it was work and that it was probably well-paid work given Shami's resources. But the attractiveness of working for the Shami campaign, which has got the uphill battle of all uphill battles, I'm talking about Kay having an uphill battle. Farouk has an uphill battle at this point against Bill White. I'm not sure that leaving the campaign is the worst thing to happen for them.
Except he's still willing to throw money around. I mean,
well, he's spending a lot of money on TV. I mean, if anybody was watching that UT
Nebraska game, there was a Farouk ad in the middle of the football game.
There was a Farouk ad at halftime. There's a Farouk ad at the end of the game. Now, that's an expensive spot. They're running spots, pretty heavy buy in Houston, an inexplicably heavy buy in West Texas, which is not usually Democratic territory. It's sort of interesting. But they are running a real television campaign. And, they just got a couple of, as you say, they've got Bill White in this race. That makes it tough. They have to overcome his name. They have to overcome his accent. He's got a great story. But it's just, you know, those are real political obstacles.
And Elise pointed out this week, Ben, that Mr. Shami has not been the most prolific voter.
That's right.
And especially in Democratic primaries, you know, he sounds like Tony Sanchez with better hair and no mustache, actually.
Well, you know, I think the biggest part of that is the whole idea of him in his campaign kickoff saying how much Barack Obama inspired him, and yet, at least according to the current records we have, he didn't even vote for him.
Apparently, didn't inspire him enough to vote. Yeah. But otherwise, it was actually.
I mean, Elise talked about this. You know, how important is it that, you know, how high of a standard should we hold elected officials to, or people that want to be elected officials to, with their voting record? And you know, I kind of go back and forth on it. But at the very least, if you're going to say Barack Obama was one hell of an inspiration to me, you should have voted for him.
If you work for Chevrolet, you ought to drive one. I mean, this is, if you want to work in the government, you ought to vote. This is not complex. I mean, you know, this is pretty simple. Some people, I guess, just like to enjoy their support for someone from their living room couch.
I'm unconflicted about this. I think the people who are in elective office have an obligation to vote. And the fact is, I'm less bothered by Shami's having voted for a Republican once in the primary than I am by his not voting hardly at all in the last number of years. That to me is a disengagement with politics and the public policy process and the elective world. That I just think it shows that he's kind of a Johnny come or a Farouk come lately, you know, to this. And the Republican thing doesn't bother me or wouldn't bother me if it were an issue. But I do think that the not voting, it's just bad.
Politics looks easy to people. We've talked about this before. Politics looks like you can just walk up in front of a camera and start talking and get elected. It looks easy. And these people, you know, people do this all the time. It's not just Farouk Shami. It may not even apply to Farouk Shami, but you know, it looks easy. It's difficult. There's a lot of stuff to think about. There's a lot of stuff to consider. And you get the feeling in campaigns like this that these otherwise really, really great, successful, smart business people walked into some enterprise without any kind of a plan at all. It's very interesting.
Unfortunately, isn't that what Senator Hutchison's campaign looks like right now?
Kind of does.
I mean.
And that brings us full circle.
Oh, thank you. I'll be getting the death threats to Ben Philpott. Thanks, there.
On behalf of Evan
Rossin. Philpott.
Thank you for listening.